It's a pity we can't devote the whole day to cardiac because this is so fascinating. You know, you'd just like everybody to go on and on. But we do understand there are other, perhaps less important organs. We'll move on to our last presentation. And moving down the line, so we've talked about cells, especially those resident within the heart and embryo, and then cells outside and inducing them into cardiomyocytes. And now we have Joseph Wu. Joe is assistant professor of medicine at Stanford University and really has been a leader in developing ways to track these cells and assess their activity in vivo. His talk will be Clinical Hurdles in Stem Cell Therapy for Heart Disease, the Role of Cardiac Imaging.
So as you know, there are several cell types for cardiovascular repair. We focus mostly on embryonic stem cells because one of the primary reasons is the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. And as a junior faculty, there's a lot of money here for you to apply grants. But what I put down here is that most of these cells are already going to clinical trial. The first four cell types, the cardiovascular stem cells, will go into clinical trial by Eduardo Marban's group and Piero Ambrosa's group. And then embryonic stem cells probably take a while. And the main reason is that with embryonic stem cells, as the previous speakers have alluded to, there are still several issues that need to be worked out, including derivation, reproducible derivation, long-term culturing, whether that affects any epigenetic stability or not, differentiation of these cells reliably into cardiac cells, how do you purify the cells to avoid teratoma formation, how do you deliver into the heart, and this is a major challenge here. I think Ken showed some engineered scaffolds. There's other issues in terms of integration into the heart as well as survival here. Now, from our lab, we're interested in tracking all these events in vivo. In vivo meaning that you don't have to kill the animal so that we can understand what happens to the stem cells once we injected them. So this is a slide of how a typical stem cell, and these are all the different manipulations we can do in the lab. You can label the cells with quantum dots. You can label the cells with the radioactive compounds. Such as F18, FDG, you can label the cells with the iron particle, and then you can do reporter gene labeling using a viral vector or non-viral vector with promoter-driving reporter gene. And all of this, the final cascade, would then be some kind of ultra-sensitive detector that allows you to detect where the stem cells are after you inject. So what I've labeled here is, in general, there's two different types. One is genetic labeling. The other one is physical labeling. The advantages and disadvantages of each technique would depend on the specific biological questions that you want to ask. At Stanford, we have, fortunately, we have a lot of tools that allow us to image these cells. Shown here, an example of micro-PET, micro-CT, micro-SPECT camera, a small animal ultrasound, small animal fluorescence that allows you to image CAP and quantum dots, small animal MR, and small animal bioluminescence imaging. And we use pretty much all of these tools to track these cells. And again, it basically depends on these particular questions that you want to ask. So what are some clinical hurdles of human ESL therapy for the next 10 years? We've identified these three major issues: immunogenicity, tumorigenicity, and safety and efficacy. In terms of immunogenicity, There is still quite a bit of considerable controversy as to whether these human ear cells are immunogenic or not. For example, if you think about it, an embryo will consist of 50% of the foreign material from the father, but yet it's not rejected by the mother. The mouse embryonic stem cells as well as the human ear cells typically express very low levels of MHC1. And then the human ear cells have also been shown to inhibit T cell proliferation. There are some other evidence showing that human ear cells are indeed immunogenic. That is, human ear cells, even though they express low levels of MHC1, once they start differentiating into embryo bodies or terminally differentiated cells, they would have MHC upregulation. And then interferon gamma can also strongly upregulate MHC1. So using imaging analysis, these are human ear cells stably transfected with the double fusion of Firefly and GAP, The GAP allows us to do immunostaining, and the Firefly allows us to do non-invasive imaging. If you inject an undifferentiated human ear cell into a biopsy mouse, you see a slight decrease in signals within the first week. But then after 10 days or so, this signal starts shooting up again. And basically, it's indicating that the cells are engrafting and causing teratoma formation. On the other hand, if you inject it into an immunocompetent biopsy mouse, the signal pretty much dies off within a week. If you come back and inject into the other leg, the signal will die off within 2 to 3 days. And that's because the immune system has already been primed to the human ear cells, and it's much faster rejection the second time around. We can also use this system to figure out what is the best drug protocol we want to give to the animal to prevent immunorejection. So, for example, if you treat the animals with a single drug, such as mycophenolate or tacrolimus or sirolimus, they actually don't do much in terms of preventing rejection. On the other hand, in our experience, when you treat it with tacrolimus and sirolimus, it can improve the survival out to 28 days. But this is still not good enough. And so in our lab, we're screening different kinds of drugs in vivo to see which one of these drugs can improve cell survival. The second issue is tumorigenicity. I think as you all know, if you inject undifferentiated cells into the heart, these cells will cause a teratoma. And we can observe this in the living animal. So this is the same animal injected with 1 million undifferentiated cells. At day 0, day 7, day 14, you start seeing the signals going up. And the signals are going up because the cells are proliferating. And at day 21, you see signals elsewhere. And this tells you some of the cells after you inject have leaked out of the heart and taken residence in other organs. In this case, it was in the liver as well as the femur area. So in our lab, we're interested in studying teratoma biology in the sense of, you know, whether different human ear cell lines will possess different abilities to form teratomas due to the way they were cultured. And what is the local environmental cues in terms of differentiation of these cells? And then what is the lower cell number of contaminant that's allowable to cause teratoma formation? This last issue is quite critical for clinical application. I mean, for example, if you were to inject 10 million human ear cell derived cardiac cells into a patient, and out of that there happens to be 100 undifferentiated cells that are contaminant, is that enough to cause teratoma? So these are the questions that we don't know, and these are the questions that we're looking into. Shown here is an example of how we do these type of experiments. On the top, we have an animal injected with 499,000 human ear cell derived cardiac cells, spiked with 1,000 undifferentiated cells. And basically, by about day 28 and 35, we don't see any teratoma formation. In the second case here, we spike it with 10,000. And then in the third case here, we spike it with 100,000. I think in our hands, typically you need about 100,000 cells to reliably form teratoma formation. And this tells us that these cells are not as robust as mouse embryonic stem cells, and that these cells need probably some kind of milieu or contact with the neighboring cells to survive. Now, what happens when the teratoma forms? Let's say, for example, you image and you see teratoma formation in a patient. What can you do about it? Well, it turns out that we do PET imaging of these cells, and PET imaging is based on using this thymidine kinase reporter gene. We can use the thymidine kinase as a suicide gene. So shown here is an example in which an animal, after 3 weeks, you see intracardiac and extracardiac teratoma formation. You treat it with ganciclovir. The ganciclovir will wipe out all the cells that are labeled with the thymidine kinase, and you see basic ablation of all these signals. The imaging allows you to figure out how long you need to treat it for. If you treat it for 2 weeks, you can ablate these signals. If you treat it for 1 week, the signal goes down, and then if you stop, the signal will pop back up again. So this is a pretty, we find it a very reliable way for us to figure out what happens in vivo. This animal, for example, if you treat it with saline, basically you see increase of the teratoma formation, and the animal eventually succumb to the tumor here. Now, the third issue is the safety and efficacy, and this is kind of alluded to earlier here. We use reporter genes to help us differentiate endothelial cells or cardiac cells, just as Mark has shown earlier. In this case, we use a vascular endothelial cadherin promoter driving EGFP. When the cells becomes endothelial cells, the green fluorescence pop up. We can isolate these ESL-derived endothelial cells. We use the same technique in a human ESL model, injected into a dorsal window. The cells are mixed with Matrigel, and you can see blood vessel formation. Now, some of these blood vessel formation comes from the endogenous host, whereas some of it comes from the human ESL-derived endothelial cells shown here. Because these cells are labeled with green color, we know these cells are human ESL-derived endothelial cells. When we inject a dye, angiosense 660, we can see some of these dye traverses inside the human ESL-derived blood vessel, and some of it is in the endogenous or the host blood vessels. And I think this video kind of shows here that you can see the dye traversing inside here, and this is the host blood vessels right here. Likewise, we also use similar, just like Mark showed, similar technique to differentiate human ESL-derived cardiac cells. We typically isolate these cardiac cells from this stage using a Pocock separation gradient to enrich and purify for our cardiomyocyte populations. And then we inject it into an animal model with myocardial infarction. And then the idea is, when you inject these cells into the heart, can you improve cardiac function? In our experience, in a short-term function, you do get improvement of short-term function at 6 to 8 weeks. However, if you were to follow this out to 3 months or 4 months, you lose the short-term functional gain. And you know, there's several hypotheses to it, but I think one of the obvious hypotheses that we can think of is the fact that most of these cells die after transplantation. This is an example of a human ESL-derived endothelial cells. Pretty much at week 8, you get less than 1% cell survival. Same thing with human ESL-derived cardiomyocytes. At week 8 or 2 to 3 months later, you get the less than 1% cardiomyocyte. So cell survival is a major issue, in our opinion, in terms of human ESL-based therapy. Just like the other labs, we're trying to figure out ways to improve the yield as well as to improve reliable differentiation to cardiac cells. We do quite a bit of microarray analysis, in this case comparing human ear cells, using clustering analysis, comparing human ear cells to human beating EBs to see how close the human ear cell-derived cardiac cells are to the fetal, human fetal cardiomyocytes. And the idea then is to figure out some kind of molecular signature that would allow us to overexpress in human ear cells to get more of these human ear cell-derived cardiomyocytes. So I think in summary, in terms of the human ear cell aspect, immunogenicity, we believe immunogenicity does exist. These cells are not the immunoprivileged, and we're trying to different ways to develop and validate strategies to improve tolerance. Tumorigenicity, we're trying to understand the effects of cell lines, cell numbers, and cell location. And keep in mind that this issue also needs to be resolved for iPS cells, right? In terms of survival and efficacy, in our experience, we get very, very poor survival long-term, and we get short-term benefits. And I think my personal hunch is that this also is this issue would also apply to the iPS-derived cardiac cells. Now, what I've shown you is mostly human ear cells, but there's no reason to believe that these molecular imaging techniques cannot be applied to adult stem cells, if you're interested in studying adult stem cells. This is an example of a study from our lab in which we created a transgenic mouse that has humanized GFP, humanized firefly. We take out the bone marrow, take out the skeletal myoblasts, and take out the mesenchymal cells and fibroblasts, and inject them into system mouse. And the system mouse has no color. So we can image what happens to the cells. And in this case, you can see, just like human ESL-derived cardiac cells, these adult stem cells also have very, very poor survival here. Now, this type of study also allows you to figure out whether these cells home to the myocardium or not, and you know, to just simulate what happens in a clinical trial. And in this case, you can we injected these bone marrow cells into the tail vein. You can see home into the myocardium. I can tell you based on these imaging analysis that the peak homing occurs within the first week. And by 1 month later, there's no more homing, and most of these cells have pretty much died off. And this is relevant clinically because I think you can tell the clinicians that if you want to inject the cells 2 to 3 months later, it probably doesn't make much sense because most of these cells were not home to the myocardium. Now, for the last 5 minutes, I just want to shift gear to the clinical application in terms of these molecular imaging approach. What I've shown you is mostly cellular, molecular, and small animal models. Ideally, we want to image what happens to the cells in the patient, and then see how the and then assess, you know, using imaging to figure out whether the cell therapy is efficacious or not. So moving there toward that goal, we're doing quite a number of large animal studies. This is an example of a large animal study in which we imaged the reported gene, herpes simplex virus thymidine kinase. We used a biocardial catheter injected into the endocardium of the pig heart, and then we can do PET imaging to see where the gene expression is, and we could co-localize it with a CT image to tell you, aha, the gene expression is located, for example, in this case, at the anterolateral wall. Now, this is a study for a European group using the construct that we built in which they labeled the porcine mesenchymal stem cells with the PET reporter gene, thymidine kinase, and used the reporter probe to track cell viability. As you can see here, they injected 6 million cells at 12 different sites. 30 hours afterwards, you see a diffuse cell uptake. 7 days later, the same animal, what happens to the signal? It's gone down. So it tells you the cells are dying during this period of time. And again, cell survival is going to be a major issue in the future. The probe that we use labeled to image the gene expression in the cells and also for gene therapy is already FDA approved as an investigational new drug. And then this is the last slide here showing this is a study between Stanford by the oncology colleagues and the City of Hope, in which they took patients with the glioblastoma, took out their cytolytic T cells, genetically modified them to express interleukin-13, as well as thymidine kinase, and then inject these cells back into the patient and to see where the, how these cytolytic T cells home to the cancer. And then you can, again, image this using this thymidine kinase reporting approach that I showed you earlier. So I want to conclude by acknowledging basically all the postdocs and students in my lab and allowing me to come here and talk, as well as my collaborators at Stanford and elsewhere. And thank you very much.